Okay, this is continuing review of communications on the Amelia Earhart case. We're reviewing the tapes that have been accumulated over the years, and this particular tape is being made now, February the 7th, 1978, and this is Elgin M. Long reviewing the tapes and making comments. Presently, we are reviewing Leo G. Bellart's tapes. He was chief radio operator on the Itasca during the Earhart search in 1937. This is tape number two, side number one, and we're picking up right where tape number two left off, and we have Leo Bellart telling about the portable direction finder on Howland Island.
Direction finder was inoperative. I didn't know it at the time. I really didn't know it at the time. I didn't know it until after we came back and picked Cipriani up. And that was, I don't know how long that trip was. Quite a long time.
Yeah, he kept a log there for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days after.
Well, he was actually up the creek because his batteries would poop out. This here is the...
I have that.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
Well, we came back.
He came back the next morning for the seaplane.
But
then you left right away.
The 16th, 17th, about the 18th, see? So we was gone about 3 weeks, I guess, before we went back and picked him up. But I didn't know that the DF was haywire. I'll tell you what it was. Been a lot of speculation on the direction finder. It kind of gripes me because one person described the thing up to 400 or 500 pounds. Honest to criminy sakes, a man didn't have good sense to say something like that. I could carry it under one arm. It wasn't heavy, you know. And didn't weigh as much as a TV, not near as much as a TV set, not by far, because one man could handle it. And supposed to have been 6 feet long on a breadboard. Well, he's crazier than nuts. But if you have any idea what a direction finder is, you know, is a breadboard, the unit itself, the receiver part, and then it came up, and then there was a loop on the top, oh, if I recall rightly, and possibly maybe a foot in diameter, which was...
Well, a small loop.
Yeah.
A small loop.
Yeah, it was only about yay big. And when it come down, the leads from the loop, when it came down, whoever designed that should design one more and then quit. He didn't even have slip rings in there. Whoever designed...
Oh, and they turned it too far and broke all the wires.
That's right, exactly. That's exactly what happened. The wires came down, and there wasn't a stop on it either. You know, so you could turn it 180 or 360, and then it'd stop. No, there wasn't any stop on it. You could take that thing around by the duct, and that's just exactly what happened. There was no stop on it. And when it came back aboard ship, I was very interested in it, and I looked it over, and hey, this thing's dead. And I started checking out, and I looked at it, and here was all the wires twisted up like a bunch of rat's tails.
Well, that's why he couldn't receive her then, and that's why I never could get a bearing, because it never was hooked up.
That's right.
Well, the receiver itself then was about 20 inches long and about a foot deep, or about...
I'll say maybe 3 feet
on
the
board. 3 feet long, about 8-10 inches high, foot high.
Yeah, it was about a foot high.
And
that is the receiver part, but the...
15 inches deep, and then about a 15-inch loop up on top of it.
Not over that.
Not as big as a normal ship's loop, more like the aircraft loop.
Yeah. Ship's loop, gee, were there about 3 feet.
Well, were the batteries internal to the receiver?
No, though they had to have storage battery.
Storage
battery operation. With the...
And a dynamo motor did it?
Dry batteries.
Oh, I see. The B power supply was by batteries also. Yeah, yeah, no dynamotor for B voltage, I see.
And that was one of his problems on Cipriani part, you know, that he kind of pooped out of power there. He wasn't equipped for 24-hour service. We had two operators, the native operator, you know. I forget what his name is. I got it in here someplace. Chinese boy.
K6. HRN or something. I have it also. I haven't been able to find those guys yet, though. But they must still live over in the islands, probably in Hawaii somewhere.
Could be. I don't know.
They were young boys.
Yeah, they were. Usually, the operators was Chinese.
How did you work Cipriani? You know, it says in the log that he was working on voice and phone. Did he have a portable?
He had our portable.
You had a little portable rig.
Yeah. I think it's a... what is it? I forget what it is. T-22 it sounds like to me, but I'm not positive. That's our designation for it.
May I ask a question in regards to the direction finder then? Howland Island reported a bearing to you that they got on a signal, I believe it was on 3105, and this is when they thought they had sighted her to the north or something. Just before that, Howland Island had taken a bearing they said was northwest of Howland.
Yeah, I remember that.
Do you think...
it's possible. I don't know. As I say, I don't know when the thing went haywire. I really don't.
Sometime, though, somebody turned that loop too far.
Somebody turned it too far.
When it came back to the ship, it had been done.
But his
basic problem that morning was the batteries were almost dead on everything, wasn't it?
Could be, yeah. His batteries and their charger on there wasn't any too...
No, they had I even know exactly what kind of a charger they had. They had a one-lung gasoline-driven thing they drove.
I was over there, but I don't recall what it was.
Well, the only reason I know is because the guy that relieved the radio operator there about 6 months later... He was describing how much trouble he was having keeping his batteries charged, and he was describing how he had to charge the batteries, which is what same thing that he'd had, and he didn't bring any new units with him, so this must have been exactly what Cipriani had to contend with. Because he said on the next day that he was charging batteries all day long.
That's in the log, really.
Yeah.
You put that stuff in the log.
The other thing that, you know, the direction finder really isn't important because you had no way to tell her where she was anyway. Of course, you might have known where to look for her better, but you probably weren't going to find her anyway.
Well, I tell you, she just, I don't know what color it is. Here it is here. Now, this is what it was said. KHAQQ, in other words, Amelia Earhart, calling Itasca. We must be on you, but cannot see you. But gas is running low. Now, that is what's said. She didn't say she's running low on gas or anything, but gas is running low.
What time was that?
0742. Now here it is. This is the rest of it. Gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. And bingo, she turns the thing off. Not say nothing at all or, you know, go ahead or this or that or the other thing.
One comment I'd like to make on that while it occurs to me. Amelia said, I have been unable to reach you by radio. In reality, she's been reaching them by radio fine. Think for a minute. They have been unable to reach her by radio. That's just a little point I wanted to make into it. I think we'll just continue right on here.
What made us, as operators, disgusted with her? She would say something like that and then hang it up, and apparently wouldn't even turn the receiver on if she had the receiver off or on or what. Nothing. Until she got stuck. You know, when she saw that Boy, her number was coming up, and then she started scratching pretty much. She should have done that way as first time she heard, you know, or called us. She should have listened for us. She apparently didn't listen for us at all.
Well, that's not really quite fair, because she had schedules. She said she would transmit at a quarter after the hour and a quarter to the hour when she could, and she would listen for them on the hour and the half hour. She didn't say that she was going to try and establish two-way communications. The only time that was done was exactly at 7:58. But she was keeping her schedule just like Spoon. And they should have been transmitting on 3105 with voice as she requested on the hour and a half hour. At least that's, I think, would be Amelia's side of it.
That's what really disturbed us, no little bit. She'd call it, or she'd come on and just say, well, the weather's overcast, this, that, and the other thing, and hang it up and not go ahead. She never tried to establish contact until the last quart of gas she had. Let's put it that way.
This seemed to cause quite a bit of consternation that she was running out of fuel already. She was supposed to have a lot more gas now, wasn't she?
Well, I don't know. Did you read Gorner's confidential stuff?
Confidential stuff?
Apparently, he checked on... Well, that's you got that there, but...
Well, as far as fuel consumption is concerned, this checked out with with Lockheed, this checked out with Clarence Kelly Johnson, and this also checks out with the fuel consumption figures that I've worked out, that she should have ran out of gas just about... when she did at 08:43, or very shortly thereafter, a little one way or the other. Regardless of the speculation at the time, that everything was in order as far as fuel consumption was concerned.
Approximately 200 miles out and 100 miles out, there was a definite build in her signal strength.
Are you asking me?
Yes, I'm asking.
Yes, actually, yeah.
And the last, when she says, I'm just about on to you, you almost wanted to go out and look because she was so loud that you...
I actually did go outside and stand right outside the radio shack and started listening like that, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to hear a motor any day, any second. Actually, we had people out on deck. We thought she was going to be flying right down into our rigging the way she... Oh, man, she come in like a ton of bricks. I mean that.
Well, you know, she only had a 50-watt transmitter. By the way, I'll show you some pictures of it. Well, I don't know whether I will or not, because there's a lot of confusion about her radio. Mr. Gurr, who installed all of her radio down at Lawton Burbank there at Paul Mance's hangar, he's in Greece, and he's going to be back this month, and I'm going to have a chance to get his story down. I haven't talked to him yet. But she only had a 50-watt transmitter, and on 3105 in the daytime to come booming in like that, she's got to be
well,
with a little laptop antenna.
In the early morning, you know, signals carry pretty good. In the mornings that way, they'll carry pretty doggone good.
Did the Ontario ever hear her?
No.
Did the Swan ever hear her?
No, she couldn't.
Did they hear you?
They couldn't. They weren't fixed for it.
Well,
the only thing they had was low frequency stuff.
The Swan had.
Well, neither one of them, as far as I know, was monitoring on flight frequency.
That may be true. They may not have been monitoring. I don't know. However, the Ontario supposedly did not have that capability, but the Swan did have the capability to monitor. But whether they were or not has never really been ascertained by me.
On 500 for them, they didn't know she couldn't. You know why? I'll tell you why, and I don't know if you know this or not. Well, I'll tell you why she didn't. Why she did away with the 500 stuff? Because 500 is all CW, and she couldn't send code.
Well, we
copy.
Knew that.
Neither her nor Noonan, neither one could use code.
They actually presented her with a license. I knew that.
She didn't.
You know, give her the license without passing the examination.
She knew an N from an A from flying the range stations
that's
back in the States,
it.
And that's all she
yeah.
knew.
She was, well, that's why when we used code or what we call ICW, you know,
yeah.
modulated CW, in other words, it's not true CW, it's modulated. When we used that, boy, we would go about two words a minute or slower. practically.
And she couldn't even copy it then. About the only way she could copy it was to copy dash, dot, and then look in the book and see that it was an M.
We were centered practically that slow.
She could have almost copied it that way.
We knew that.
But that's why she did away with the 500. But she forgot one thing. The ships could have homed on her. All she had to do was just hold the key down. And you could have taken bearings on her on 500.
Oh, man, yes.
And she forgot that when she took it out.
That's a interesting, I find it interesting that Leo keeps saying that he knew that she and Noonan couldn't copy the code. I do know that in the official reports shortly thereafter, they did establish that neither Earhart or Noonan was able to copy the code at any speed. And the conversation is more or less correct, but not quite as purposeful as it sounds.
Could you send voice on 7,500 kilocycles?
Sure.
About what power transmitters were you using on 3105? You had one transmitter on 3105.
We could shift back and forth very easy.
Did you have a transmitter set up on 3105, 6210, and 7500?
We could shift to any one of those. That's all we had to do is turn around, and there you are.
Okay, that is not true. Now, Leo knew better than that. Any radio operator that operated the T-16 and T-10 and T-14 and T-4, which were on the ship, knew that the T-16 was strictly a CW transmitter. And he knew that the T-10, which was the only transmitter they had on board capable of transmitting A3 or voice signals, was the T-10. And he knew that the top frequency of the T-10 was just a little over 4,000 kilocycles or kilohertz. Why he said positively and made that statement leaves me in doubt, because it becomes a very important point later on, and it's almost inconceivable that Leo did not know that 7,500 kcs, that he wouldn't remember that. It's the sort of thing that a radio operator would very definitely remember.
If at all possible, I wonder if I could get you to just have me sketch, or you sketch a little diagram of the radio room. Can you
Man,
remember?
What
you can't remember. You'd be surprised if you sat down what you could.
And he did, and I have a copy of it on the back of that folder, the thing that he did at that time.
And you had your transmitter here.
And your T4 on it?
That's a 4, T4. That was very, very rarely used. It was an excellent, it was a wonderful transmitter. But we had no use for it down there on that particular frequency. Low frequency job.
I see, it was a 500 jobber.
Then you had a shelf with your receivers. See? Mm-hmm. Here are your receivers.
Okay, that was the end of tape one. We just finished side 1B. Now this is tape number 2. Tape 2A of the Leo G. Bellarts tapes. Tape 2A is starting now.
This one thing I was kind of surprised, you know, that you said, and that was that the Swan had HF. I'm sure the Swan had HF equipment. Well, wait a minute, I'm not either sure of that. I'm not sure of anything, but the Swan, to your knowledge, the Swan nor the Ontario ever heard one single thing from you or her or anybody on 3105 or 6210. You never did hear her on 6210 either, no, I'm sure of that.
No.
Well, were the guys on Howland and Baker and Jarvis, were they listening in? They were all amateurs.
Yes, if their batteries was up, you know. In them days, it was nothing but a dry battery outfit yet, you know, for their V batteries. And they had to charge their A batteries, so to speak. So it was a little problem there with them. As far as Baker is concerned, or Jarvis, neither one of them They weren't in on the deal at all.
Well, now, you were working, Baker, at the time, and yet there's nothing in the logs that ever indicates anybody ever asked them if they had heard.
They were asked at one time, and they come back negative.
They didn't hear.
I don't think they even tried.
They weren't listening on 3105. They were on their regular amateur frequency and just let it go at that.
And their receivers, actually, I think their receivers at that time was something comparable to what you called an SW3.
Wasn't very good.
No. SW3, that means three tubes.
I see.
See?
Probably a TRF.
TRF, yes. One TRF stage and one detector and one amplifier, and that's what it amounted to. They weren't a bad receiver, really.
But not as good as your HRO, buddy. Well, now, you only had the one HRO then.
We had one, two, three, four, five, six. I think we had seven receivers on there at the time. Seven or possibly eight. Seven and
nine. Well, was your 3105 and 6210... set up at the same time, or didn't have to pull a coil out and change it?
No.
It was all...
You're thinking HRO. We didn't use HROs. I don't think we used an HRO for that.
They did have the one that was bored in Honolulu and was used.
We had an HRO. I think that was put on the Navy. No. It tells you right here on your log... I know one of these log sheets here is... Yeah, 32-1, CGR 32, that receiver.
Well, where does it say that? I'm just curious. I see, that's what that means, huh?
CGR 32, that's the type of receiver.
CGR 32...
Coast Guard receiver 32-1. They had 32-1, 2, 3 of future models. See?
Okay, and that's what you were using to listen on 3105.
Well, that was one of the receivers. That was one of the receivers. That was one. And we actually got a... oh, man, what kind was it? No, I don't know if it's even listed in here. That was one. And we actually got a... oh, man, what kind was it? No, I don't know if it's even listed in here. Anthony brought down a receiver from Honolulu, and he says, brought down another receiver for you. He says, it might come in handy. And so I just took it was a good receiver, but it was not the run-of-the-mill Coast Guard, you know, shipboard receivers, but it was a good receiver.
And that would be the HRO that he's talking about. And they mentioned in the log that at one time Kenner was tuning the HRO for Earhart.
See, was the bridge hearing your radio just out the door, or was there a speaker outside the radio room somewhere?
Was there what?
The bridge was hearing what was coming across, hearing her talk through a loudspeaker.
No. The loudspeaker you're talking about is actually the loudspeaker that was in the radio room.
It was in the radio room. Normally you use phones, but you could put it on a speaker.
Well, you only got two ears, let's put it that way. You only got two ears, and we was using split phones. Mm-hmm. One receiver for one frequency, one for another, and if there was any other frequencies, it was on a loudspeaker. But the loudspeakers was usually the dead frequencies, unless it was something like that. When she got real close, pull that one phone out, put the loudspeaker on it, and then everybody in the shack could hear. That, I believe, is how O'Hare got some of that information in his log.
He was listening, and nothing was going on in his frequency.
Well, you could hear it in the radio room, and you could go outside on deck and hear her. She was so doggone loud.
Right. So just coming out the door, then...
That's right. But I don't think they could hear that on a bridge. That was a little too far-fetched.
This 30 minutes routine, then that just came up out of left field somewhere. Then I have 30 minutes fuel remaining, 1/2 hour.
Well, I'll tell you how that happened, I believe. After the flight, I think it actually took place, I don't recall if it was going into Honolulu on the way north, you know, or if it was from Honolulu going back home to Frisco. I don't recall. But I remember the old man was down there, Thompson, Baker, myself. I don't know if even Sutter was there. I don't know.
Did Commander Kenner get in on part of this stuff, too?
No.
He stayed out of it.
Oh, he was more or less of an observer. He was a nice guy. I didn't know him before. But he was a pretty nice guy. But anyway, the old man, Baker, and myself, and there seemed to be somebody else there, and I can't recall who that was. I don't think it was Sutter, the radio officer. But anyway, I think it was a navigator, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, we was down there, yeah, I think it was a navigator, because he had to put some of the stuff in as far as the ship's log is concerned. And they was concocting up a long letter to search report. And that, I think, was put in that report. It should never have been put in. They misquoted it. But that is what I read you. That is what came over the air. And somebody made it. I know Fred Garner. He got on that, too. Yeah.
Well, it got into O'Hara's log somehow, too. He says 30 minutes of fuel.
Well, if O'Hara did then maybe that's where the stuff came from. Because, as I said, O'Hara should have never put some of that stuff in there. It was not his responsibility. Just confusion to it.
Let me read what O'Hara... He copied the same message at the same time. Let me read to you what he said. Just to see if that's maybe where it all came from. I got so many logs and I keep losing the dates. He says here, Earhart on now, says running out of gas, only 1/2 hour left. Can't hear us at all. We hear her and are sending on 3105 and 500 same time constantly and listening in for her frequency.
That's stinking O'Hara.
He copied that at 0730.
0730?
Yeah.
Well, he's off 10 minutes, 12
well,
minutes.
Well, 0730 to 0740. You know how that
is. Well, yeah, okay.
Somewhere's
okay,
in between
yeah.
there.
Well, actually, it's logged down here, completed at 0742. It started at 0741, and it took him a minute to...
I'll make a copy of this log and send it.
Huh?
I'll make a copy of this and send it to you so
you'll
have it.
Well, it's in error.
Yeah.
It's in
well, then,
error.
Then O'Hara's log then is...
O'Hara's log, it should never have been an O'Hara's log.
He's just
adding confusion to it, and that is not correct. Possibly that's where that come up from, you know. And possibly O'Hara might have had something in his little punkin' head that you might have, thought, well, he's going to make a bundle of jack on that or something.
You had Galton and Thompson in the two critical positions. Evidently, you trusted
not
both.
Not Thompson, really. Thompson was pulled
as soon as things got hot.
Yeah. Thompson was a good man. I wouldn't want to downgrade him or nothing like that. But Thompson was a very peculiar individual. He was an ex-Army man, ex-Army operator, and you'd tell him to do something, and he would do it as long as it fit with his idea. He's the only man that I ever nailed, and I'd have crucified that guy. I gave him some schedules to keep, radio schedules, and he just disregarded them. And I put him down for a shot. And, the officers saw fit to overlook it. But it got me got me a little bit disturbed, because the way I feel, I don't know, I'm not a perfectionist by any means, but if I make a schedule with somebody on radio, come hell or high water, I'm going to keep that schedule if I can humanly possible do it.
He's talking about schedules that were, while they were going from Honolulu down to Howland Island. San Francisco NMC reported, wanted to know the name of the radio operator on duty who didn't keep a schedule. Bellarch did put Thompson on Captain's report. He went to Captain's mast, and Commander Thompson accepted Thompson's excuse of why the schedule wasn't kept. And that's what Leo's referring to.
I looked, and it really blew my cork.
Well, then you felt Galton was...
Galton, yes. I could give Galton a job, and Galton would go ahead and carry it through. He would do what I told him to, and I was perfectly, at ease, because I knew Galton was a reliable man. He was a good man. But Thompson, he was a good operator. I won't put him down for that. Thompson was a good operator, maybe better than Galton. Operator is concerned. But as far as reliability, I'd put Galton ahead of Thompson. Now, that was why...
Why you had Galton on.
Yeah, and Tom Tommy O'Hare, I had him and Thompson on that so-called fast circuit, press circuit, to Honolulu and so forth, because they could handle that. They was fast operators. They was fast operators. Galton possibly was not quite as fast as Thompson. But that's the...
But other than that, you knew he was damn reliable and
Galton, yes. Methodical. He was very reliable. And when I knew it, he was on the job, he was on the job. Going to do the best
and
he could possibly.
And Cipriani, you explained earlier, you sent him ashore because somebody had to learn how to do the direction
finder, right.
And he didn't know anything about the ship, so let him
that's
be the one.
That's right. And we needed another operator anyhow, so, well, it just fell to him, and that was it. I never did know what happened to Galton. In fact, Galton didn't even know what happened to me. When we came back, he went one way and I went the other, and that was it, In fact, Galton didn't even know what happened to me. When we came back, he went one way and I went the other, and that was it,
Well, you say then on 7500, 3105, 6210, you could transmit voice on those frequencies.
Oh, yes. Oh, man, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Never sure on 7500 whether you could or not. I knew you could on 3105 and 6210.
Yeah.
That, even I'm wrong there. But it's very, very definite that they could not transmit voice on 6210 or 7500. And I find it extremely significant that Bellarts continues to insist that they could, when it is a fact they could not, and it makes me suspect why. That's the end of Bellarts tape number two, side A. This is Bellarts tape number two, side B now.
A question I've been meaning to ask you, and I keep forgetting. As these messages came in, it's obvious from what she was saying that they didn't think they were lost. I'm about 200 miles out. I'm approximately 100 miles out. I should be on you, but I don't see you.
Yeah.
From that point on, was there any change in her method of transmission or in her voice or anything when she started to realize that things
were... Well, I'll tell you, the last time we heard her on that she said she was going to repeat it on 6210... And she never got up there, We never heard from her again. Actually, her voice, we could hear her voice just as easy as I'm hearing yours right now, and I'm deaf in one ear now. But I tell you, you could hear it all over the shack and even outside the shack, Real loud and clear, I mean it. She was a woman. We heard her quite a few times, But that last one, I'm telling you, it sounded, if she would have broken out in a scream, it would have sounded normal. She was just about ready to break in tears and go into hysterics. That's exactly the way I describe her voice, and I'll never forget it.
It was controlled. The voice was controlled,
well,
but it had the...
if you could call it controlled, you know, but I tell you, she was just on the verge, I mean, of just saying, boom, and letting it go. She was just on the verge of going into hysterics.
I mean that. Do you think she ever transmitted anything on 6210?
No. I think actually that's when she went. I actually think by the time she was shifting from one frequency to the other, I think that is exactly the time when she went into the drink.
Within a minute or two of that last radio
message. Just a minute or two, because she was overdue as far as her gasoline was concerned. She said she was low, you know.
That was over an hour earlier.
Well, that's it. That's it. How low is a different proposition. That's what Earl Gorner, he wrote to me, and he took exception to that 30-minute deal, too, see? How that got in
there. I think you know now how that got in
there. You want to read Dwiggin's letter?
United States Coast Guard logs. But, by the way, I noticed Cipriani was a day off on his logs. He had the wrong date.
Could be. I'm paying attention to Cipriani's log anyhow.
Okay. And, you know, it's interesting to take the logs and convert everything to Greenwich Mean Time, and sometimes some of the things Amelia Earhart said makes a little more sense, because she was on a half hour off where you were, because you were on 11 and a half hours, according to your log. Reconstructing the scene, I just might have dead bailed facts. Sorry you took an insult about the shirts. DF equipment new and beginning. Cap Thompson, best call from experienced radio in first class. Regarding the confusion between GMT and GCT, in the Navy and United States Coast Guard logs, again, no insult meant. As a commercial pilot with some ocean flying experience, I was trying to point out that such duality can be confusing. It wasn't me, but another writer who referred to the time discrepancies as evidence of possible skullduggery. I, in fact, point out that you and your mates did a remarkable job at tracking Lee Earhart's airplane.
This is a letter from Don Dwiggins to Leo Bellarts, answering some of the things that Leo Bellarts criticized him about in his book Hollywood Pilot. I just wanted to get that part in there about you can't pay any attention to Frank Cipriani's logs anyway. I don't know if we can elaborate on that later or not.
The only thing that we heard here was at 0453. And that I copied that myself. And that's all you can hear is part cloudy. That's all I could get out of her.
Part cloudy, though.
Yeah,
not this cloudy and overcast.
The static was something terrific. You know, just crash in on your ears. And I'll guarantee you that Hanslick and that other joker never heard that. I got a big...
You'd be on the phones then. You wouldn't
be on the speaker. Oh, I'd be definitely on the phones. Absolutely. Not on no loudspeaker. You couldn't hear that. Because you were just fighting to get every breath, you know.
Well, up until that last transmission... her voice was quite cool, was it, or...?
Very calm, cool, and collected, yes.
But the last transmission pressure was on.
Boy, I'll tell you, I'll never forget her voice. You could hear her voice just starting to crack, you know how it is?
Have you ever heard recordings of her?
No.
I am just sorry. I don't have one on me. I could play it for you. I have the Swan... And you really don't know if the guys on Howland Island or Baker ever heard her.
No, they never heard her. They never heard her. We checked with them. We checked with them later. Quite some time when the old man was... And as far as that, Dwiggins, you know, saying that he used Captain Thompson's report, that's all repeat stuff. That's all repeat stuff. Captain was using his own vocabulary. You get the point?
Mm-hmm.
He was using his own vocabulary, not exactly the way it was possibly on the log. He may have made a little change here and there using different English. See? There's nothing against... I'm not putting a thing against Captain Thompson. I think the world of that man.
I understand he was a real, real fine officer.
Well,
I'll tell you one
little story about Captain Thompson. Marty. I've got that stuff in here. I'll tell you what it is. We had several reports, and that is what Captain Thompson was confused on this Dwiggins letter, criminal, so forth, transmissions. Well, I know, because we sweated it out over some of those phony ones, and San Francisco office was no help. They was getting those reports, too, and they was sending it out, and they actually was trying to direct our movements from San Francisco. They were crazy.
You don't hold with any one of those messages, then, that from that 8:42 in the morning or 43, whenever it was, that's the last time any radio wave ever emanated from her airplane, as far
under
as
that
concerned.
Log, yes. Absolutely right. As far as the Itasca is concerned, I went on her in February 15th, 1937.
February 15th, 1937.
That's right. And I left it April 12th, 1938.
April 12th, 38.
That's right.
You were on it for a year then, 1 year tour.
That's right. And before that, I was on the Shawnee.
You were on the Shawnee before that.
Yeah. And after I left the Itasca, I went to the Northland, which went to Alaska.
Do you think your transmitters was putting out at all?
Oh, I don't know, a couple hundred watts at least. A
couple hundred.
Oh, yeah, sure. I don't remember what it was. We could control it, you know, up or down.
Well, I was wondering...
But we had more than ample power, let's put it that way.
Were people hearing you at all? Was Honolulu hearing you or Tutia? I mean, on the 3105 or 6210.
We didn't really check on that, but I know this, that on 3105 we was heard in the Midwest.
At some different, whenever the skip was right.
Well, I mean, while we was working out there, some hams was, what was it, Colorado, Utah, some dog.
Copying in. Well, what I was thinking, I was trying to figure... Okay, and this is part of the conversation now. Perhaps Leo doesn't remember the power outputs of the various transmitters. Though most other radio men I talked to who had been that long ago and on that type of equipment did remember. But perhaps he didn't. However, as far as you say, and they're not checked, of course the logs do show that they did check, and they show that nobody was hearing them. And as far as anyone in the Midwest hearing them on 3105 on voice, I don't know of any substantiation for that, for what it's worth or not worth. Anyway, we positively, and
well,
I know...
Honestly, I'll tell you the fact. I actually stuck that outside the shack and listened like that, and for a couple of minutes I went up on the bridge, Galton took over or something, I don't remember. I know I was on the bridge, and the guys on the bridge, you know, on the flying bridge, they was out there actually listening for her. That's how close I thought she was, really. Really, I thought she was going to fly right down in on our antennas.
She sounded just as loud or louder than Cipriani did on
shore. Well, Cipriani, he only had the rig he had over there was...
like a one and a half watt, right?
Less than a watt.
Right.
It was just a very small transmitter. Very small. It is a strictly dry battery powered rig. That's what it amounted to. But we even worked him for crying's sake. Gee whiz.
Well, she was that close when she said, I must be on you, but can't see you. And then you say she was that same, almost the same signal strength when that last message came
in.
Well,
she was so loud, she couldn't hardly get any louder. She could hardly get
you're almost out. Blocking your receiver.
That's right. That's right.
God, she only had a little 50 watt.
I know it.
She had a little V antenna from one tail up to near the cockpit, back to the tail with this offset
feed. I had quite a bit of experience as far as plane monitoring because.
Well, you worked for.
Well, before I went to the Itasca. I was at Point Vicente, and we used to be plane guard down there at Point Vicente for planes out of San Diego. Every time a plane would take off from San Diego, we would set plane guard on him. So I had a little experience with...
used to the fast movement of planes and the small wattage and
They used to come over Point Vicini and wave at us, you know, wave their wings, so to speak, and they'd fly right over us. But this here is just my rough log as far as my different
all
duties.
The duties you had,
right? Yeah. Oh, memos on tape and adding that on there because just as Fred Gorner says, someday everybody will know everything. Well, there's still some things that has nothing to do with the flight, really, you know, the outcome of it, but a personal history, let's put it that way.
Okay, this is the end of side one of tape number two of the Communications Review, Itasca, July 1937, Elgin M. Long. I'll switch sides now to side two.